From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we answer some of the biggest questions about the COVID-19 vaccine. We learn about the origins of the body mass index and why we shouldn't take it as a serious measurement of health.
It doesn't directly measure anything about a disease or your health. It's used to warn people because of relationships that we have seen with BMI and other diseases.
Bubbler Talk explores why there aren't any historically designated landmarks for Milwaukee's Latino community. Plus, we hear how the Tandem restaurant has shifted its focus to food insecurity during the pandemic.
Cooking food, putting in a box, and handing it to folks who are facing hunger is different. But I think we've always kind of been a part of that process. It just looks a lot different now.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we'll talk about the origins of the Body Mass Index, or commonly known as BMI. Bubbler Talk explores the lack of historical monuments dedicated to Milwaukee's Latino community. We'll learn about the Tandem Restaurant's efforts to relieve food insecurity during the pandemic, plus what seeds to sow inside as we prepare for our spring and summer gardens. First, today is a big day for Wisconsin. All Wisconsinites 16 and older are now eligible for the COVID-19 vaccine. It marks what many are hoping is the beginning of the end of this pandemic, here and throughout the country. But there are a lot of lingering questions about what vaccination will really mean for people. Kim Litwack is the dean of the College of Nursing at UW-Milwaukee, and she joins me now to answer some of these questions. Kim, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Glad to be here.
When are you considered fully vaccinated? Is it immediately after getting the second shot, or when does that happen?
Full immunity is considered to be approximately 2 weeks after the second shot if it's a Pfizer or Moderna vaccination. If it's a J&J, Johnson & Johnson vaccine, where you only need one, again, it's about 2 weeks afterwards.
Why is that?
Well, it takes a little while for the body to build an immune response, and 2 weeks seems to be when that is optimized. So we do encourage folks to continue wearing masks, continue being smart in decision-making and social distancing up until that point, and even after that point, because not everyone is vaccinated yet.
I was about to ask, there are definitely things that we know we can do once we're fully vaccinated, but when it comes to things like masks or socially distancing, what are the things to keep in mind?
Well, again, we don't know whether everyone's vaccinated. If you're in a closed circle, or you've expanded your social circle and you know everyone's vaccinated, enjoy being together with friends and family again. But since we're in public venues where we don't know that, then masks are still encouraged. Social distancing has now been reduced to 3 feet by the CDC, but good hand washing and paying attention to one's surroundings are always smart.
Now, is the danger there that you could catch COVID-19 or that you would be carrying it, giving it to somebody else?
Well, when I wear a mask, I protect you. When you wear a mask, you protect me. And since we don't know everyone's vaccination status out there in the world, it's just good practice. We want to prevent exposure. We want to prevent the spread of COVID-19. So it's just good safety when you're in a situation where you really don't know.
Now, here in the U.S. and in other countries around the world, we're experiencing another wave. If you've been vaccinated, should you still be concerned that we have these heightened rates?
Well, those heightened rates may be coming from two different sources. One, there may be COVID-19 variants out there that are new, and we're learning more about those every day. The other is that we've now been dealing with this COVID pandemic for over a year, and people are tired. They're tired of wearing masks. They're tired of hand sanitizers. They're tired of being locked in their houses. So I think we're seeing some complacency, and we all need the reminders that until we have really good herd immunity, where we know that we've got lots of people vaccinated, we still need to be safe and take precautions.
You mentioned these variants. I think when people hear about the new variants, they get concerned that even getting the vaccine, they're still possibly going to catch one of these variants that seem to spread more easily and evade detection longer. Is that a concern?
Well, I think there's a lot we don't know about these new variants, so we're going to have to watch the scientific literature and all of us stay abreast as best we can with that information. But one thing we do know about the COVID-19 vaccines, number one, they're safe, and number two, they prevent serious disease. So even with the variants, and if someone were to come down with symptoms or test positive because of a variant, ideally it's going to keep them out of the hospital, out of the ICU, and keep them from dying.
So most likely the vaccine will at the very least provide some amount of protection from severe disease, it seems.
Correct. That's the hope, is that we are able to get on top of this, decrease hospitalizations, decrease long-term effects, and more importantly, stop the deaths that are coming from this disease.
That gets to this bigger question about the vaccine in general. I think a lot of people are really excited to get it right now, but we don't exactly know how long it's going to last. Do we have any idea if this is going to be like influenza, where we're getting it, you know, once a year or possibly twice a year, depending on how quickly it evolves? Do we know how long this might be effective?
We don't. Influenza is treating a virus, and that does require yearly boosters. It's too soon to tell on the COVID-19 vaccine at this time.
Another thing that people have been concerned about is possibly spreading COVID-19, even though they have the vaccine. Is that something that's a possibility?
Theoretically, no. We shouldn't be carriers once we are fully vaccinated.
Okay. Now, there are a lot of questions, of course, about what people can do. So we know that it's still a good idea to wear a mask when you're in public, when you're in groups of people that you don't necessarily know. But can you do things like travel freely? Should you worry about getting on a plane or a bus?
Making decisions about traveling really comes down to risk versus benefit. And if there's a benefit to you to go see your grandkids or go see your parents, and you've been vaccinated and the only way to get there is on a plane, you don't know everyone on the plane. So you want to be safe. You wear your mask, you wipe down your tray tables. You try not to eat and drink on the plane if you can help it. Be safe. Just be smart. You know, when we were kids, our parents used to say, make good decisions. The same thing comes with treating COVID and traveling. Make good decisions. If you can road trip it. You have more control. If you can't, be as smart and safe as you can.
There are, I think, so many questions. We could go down the line of kind of, you know, item by item, what can you do, what can't you do? And I think a lot of it's going to come down to safety and, you know, personal choices, personal decisions, as you just said. For you, what have been the most frequently asked questions? What are the things that you've found people are most interested in knowing?
I think the first and foremost is, when can I get my vaccine? We did a very deliberate rollout in this country, starting with healthcare providers and then with those with coexisting diseases. And then we expanded the age groups. And Wisconsin is really fortunate to be able to, starting next week, vaccinate anyone over the age of 16. But that's been the biggest question. How soon can I get vaccinated? We do have some folks that are looking for a specific vaccine. They want Johnson & Johnson because it's a one and done. We have people looking for Pfizer because that's the one that's approved for children over the age of 16. So there's a lot of vaccine related questions. We've all been carrying this very heavy load on our shoulders for the last year. And I think it's been there so long that you don't even realize it's there. I think folks just want to know when this is all going to be over. And we don't really have an answer, but we try and acknowledge that everything they do, when they show up to a vaccine clinic, when they wear a mask, when they use hand sanitizer, it's every one of us playing our role in stopping this pandemic.
Kim Litwack is the Dean of the College of Nursing at UW-Milwaukee. We spoke with her last week. Right now, all Wisconsinites 16 and older are eligible for the COVID-19 vaccine. You can find more of our COVID-19 coverage at WUWM.com. There aren't any historically designated landmarks in the city of Milwaukee dedicated to the Latino community. Coming up, Bubbler Talk explores why that is and efforts to change it. But first, we learn about the origins of the Body Mass Index and why it isn't always an accurate measurement of health. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. As of today, if you're 16 or older in Wisconsin, you're eligible to get a COVID-19 vaccine. Before now, Wisconsinites could be eligible if they were elderly, had certain jobs, or certain medical qualifications, including a body mass index, or BMI, of 25 or higher. This BMI range is categorized as overweight. 30 or above is considered obese. This qualification made almost 70% of Wisconsinites eligible, but it also brought up a lot of questions about how we measure health and view body weight. To help us understand BMI and how much weight we should truly give it, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke with Paula Papanek, Marquette University's Director of Exercise Science. She begins by explaining the origins of BMI.
It was developed without really any clinical or physiology or medical reasons behind it. It was developed in the 1830s by a sociologist who was also a mathematician and basically a stats guy. And at the time, he called it social physics, and he was describing what the shape of normal men were in Belgium. He is not an MD. Again, he is not a physiologist or anything like that. It was created out of a curiosity. He was just trying to describe, as a sociologist, what people looked like back then. And it wasn't until really the 1970s that it was named BMI. Before that, again, it wasn't called Body Mass Index. In 1972, it was rediscovered, if you will, and then officially named Body Mass Index.
So in 1972, when it was renamed BMI, was there a different range for men versus women, or is the same range that was just for white men in Belgium still applied to both sexes today?
Well, so back even before 1972 and in Belgium, there were no ranges. It was just a math to describe what people were, men, not people, men, right? And in the United States, prior to the 1970s, we used height and weight charts to describe the population. And then it became obvious that someone that's tall could weigh a whole lot more than someone that's short, right? And the charts that they used for, they're called the Metropolitan Height and Weight Charts, weren't very useful. So in the 1970s, when BMI was named, they began to use this ratio of essentially how wide or heavy you are for your height, right? And by the 1980s, it was widely adapted. And up until really quite some time, there was no difference, or there were differences between men and women, but they weren't really meaningful for anything. All right. So in other words, the formula to calculate BMI, weight divided by height in meters squared, is the same all over the world. And so, no, there really aren't differences between men and women now. And now there are tables that are color-coded that divide what category you are in based on your height and your weight. And yes, these have changed over time, because when I was growing up, the maximum height that was on a BMI chart for women was 5'10". So I was off the chart, so to speak, by junior high. And so you couldn't even look up my BMI when I was in junior high, because they didn't have tables for that. But you could certainly calculate it.
So let's go over the range of BMI right now. So to give listeners an example, I looked my BMI up. It's 28.2, which technically is overweight. I am also over 6 feet. I'm close to the obesity range in BMI. So, you know, let's contextualize this for listeners. What's the general range that people fall under?
Sure. So normal would be, since 19 19- 98. Normal BMI would be a range of 18.5 to 24.9. Overweight, 25 to 29.9. And obese would be greater than 30. But since we've had such an obesity epidemic and we are concerned about the health risks of obesity and we've gotten heavier as a nation, we've even added additional categories for obesity. And so we now have obesity class 1, which is a BMI of 30 to 35, and obesity class 2, 35 to less than 40. Extreme obesity or severe, a BMI of 40 to 45, and morbid obesity of a BMI of greater than 45. And again, it doesn't take rocket science to know that those are severely overweight individuals.
So is BMI still considered an accurate measure of health, or as you're alluding to, is it just about differentiating health measurement versus a risk assessment?
That's a great question. All right. What BMI really is a screening tool. It doesn't directly measure anything about a disease or your health. It's used to warn people because of relationships that we have seen with BMI and other diseases. And it's particularly good to look at trends in large populations. So when we measure in a big disease clinical trial and we measure BMI, and it describes, all right, visually what the people look like. A health measurement for a disease, in contrast, would be something like measuring your blood sugar or measuring your blood pressure. Those are direct measurements of your health that can be part of a disease or just good measurement of what's happening in your body. So what BMI has done is take, and BMI hasn't done this, but what large cohort studies have done is take large groups of people, measure their height and weight, calculate their BMI, and then say how many people in each one of these categories have which diseases, right? And they look at that and say it's a trend, right? So there's a trend, right? And it's a strong trend for BMI to increase or be associated with an increased risk of lots of diseases and even death, because we know that people with a higher BMI are at greater risk of having coronary artery disease, high lipids, type 2 diabetes, gallbladder disease, hypertension, even osteoarthritis and sleep apnea, and heck, even fertility. There are over 10 types of cancer, for example, that are associated with a higher risk of obesity. And that's in part because what we know about belly fat is that it is metabolically active and in fact is inflammatory, and that those diseases have a lot of inflammation associated with their pathology. And so, vague or not, whether BMI is vague, it has a vague estimate of obesity, we know that the mortality rate for people with a real low BMI, less than 20, and a BMI greater than 25, it's higher. And there are huge data sets across multiple continents that bear this fact out. It's not causal necessarily, but it does describe, and therefore, from a medical perspective, allows us to warn and intervene in people that are creeping up on the BMI scale.
So why use BMI for vaccine distribution? What's the rationale behind that?
Well, first of all, we know that overweight and obesity are risk factors in terms of COVID for invasive mechanical ventilation, hospitalization, ICU admission, and death, particularly in adults less than 65 years of age. 30% of COVID hospitalizations were attributed to obesity. So it makes sense to target this population. Remember that if we had all the vaccine in the world, we wouldn't have to create criteria for people to get in line, but we don't. And so we started with nursing homes and medical first line providers and people that we know were at high risk. And then what? Okay, how do we tell people when to get in line, which is what everybody wants to know, right? When do I get in line? So we needed an easy, understandable qualification, something that was objective. Because we know that BMI and the risks of COVID, severity of COVID, is very real, it was the next logical choice. And the thing that you have to understand about calculating BMI is that I don't have to really touch you, right? It is neutral, relatively speaking. I don't form an opinion when I make that measurement. It's just an objective measure. Yet it can be misused, okay? And the fact that folks that are struggling with eating disorders or body dysmorphia, forcing them to look at their BMI can be very traumatic. But it's also not a good measurement for people that are on the extremes of sizes in height, either too short or too tall. BMI is also bad for things like weight class sports. And that's resulted in a lot of crazy and unhealthy behaviors in athletes. And then lastly, we worry about words and labels about people, that BMI of this is obese or BMI over this is severe obese. So we try not to use those categories in terms of the general public. And we particularly don't want to use those words when we work in pediatrics or with children. And so instead, what we use is percentile ranks, comparing peers at the same age and sex. But there are not obese or severe obesity labels in terms of pediatrics.
Do you think, you know, talking outside of the classification for vaccine distribution, which can group a lot of people together, when it comes for more specifics, when it comes to our health, should we have a different level of measurement techniques, that BMI should not be the end-all be-all? Because sometimes BMI can qualify or disqualify you depending on your insurance. If that's not an accurate measurement of health, you know, should we be rid of this essentially, or should it just not have so much emphasis or power?
I think what you're hitting on to is the issue of how robust of a measure is this in terms of health risks. And are there other measurements that are easily made? Right? And the fact is that there aren't other measurements to make easily. A waist to hip ratio, measuring how big your belly is, knowing where that fat is carried, would be a much better risk factor for all these conditions that we're talking about. Absolutely. But they're not easy. And they're definitely not something that can be scaled up and not require a trained technician in order to do it and to do it easily and to do it well. So really, it's just hard to measure. Okay. The only really good ways to measure body fat are in research labs.
So overall, we should take BMI with a grain of salt.
I think that's a great thing to say. What we know about BMI is that, again, if you're in the extremes, we're overestimating or underestimating. You have to look at that data and the individual, okay? Do they look like that? And again, an athlete would be a perfect example. They have a lot of muscle. 1 pound of muscle is very dense compared to a pound of fat. But they're still a pound, right? And so an athlete can put on a lot of muscle mass, be very dense, and appear heavy on a scale. And when that happens, they will have an abnormally high BMI that would make them look on a medical chart or on an insurance record as being obese. And so they probably don't care. But if they did, and I have had this happen where wrestlers couldn't compete at a certain category or someone was denied insurance, well, then you come to a research laboratory and you get a better measurement and you take it up to the level of measurement that's needed to demonstrate that your physiology is healthy at that BMI.
Well, it's certainly interesting to see how much we can delve into this and what we should keep in mind when considering all these measurements of health. So, Paula, I want to thank you so much for helping us to understand BMI a little better.
Sure, you're very welcome.
Paula Papanek is the Director of Exercise Science at Marquette University and Fellow of the American College of Sports Medicine.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Angelina Mosier Salazar. Historical sites, Milwaukee is filled with them. Like the opulent Victorian mansion of Frederick Pabst, the president of, yes, you guessed it, Pabst Brewery. or even the Wisconsin Historical Society's building on Old World 3rd Street in Kilbourne. Originally built as a bank more than 100 years ago, it is outfitted with a mezzanine, atrium, and scagolia columns, which apparently make marble columns look pedestrian. But Bubbler Talk listener Eloisa wanted to know,
what and where are the historic landmarks that people can go to get a better sense of the local Latino history?
With the first Latinos arriving more than 100 years ago and the community making up almost 20% of city residents, I thought, great, I'll just look on TripAdvisor for the answer. Well, turns out there isn't one. Okay, well, I'd give a walking tour of Hispanic historical sites a try. There isn't one of those either. So I turned to the Wisconsin Historical Society database and started searching and searching and searching. And nothing. I thought I was missing something, but it turns out I wasn't.
There are no official sites listed on either the National Register or in the State Register. That doesn't mean, of course, that those sites don't exist. It just means that they haven't been recognized by those official channels.
That's Sergio Gonzalez, professor of history and Latinx studies at Marquette University. And he says Latinos aren't largely considered part of Wisconsin's history.
The way in which we recognize specific places as being historically relevant in many ways dictates what we think is important about who we are as a people. And the fact that Latinos don't have any recognized place on the National Register speaks to that larger forgetting of a century-long history of our people in the state.
I reported back to Eloisa, our Bubbler Talk listener.
The answer to your question is that there are no official historic sites in Milwaukee that commemorate or honor the Latino community.
That's horrible. That really is. That's so sad.
It is awful. As a reporter who covers issues in the Latino community, I have to admit I was surprised to learn that there are no historical landmarks to reflect the history and impact of Milwaukee's Latino community. Professor Gonzalez says there are reasons for that. One is the convoluted process of actually making something a historic landmark.
It's a lot of paperwork. It requires a certain amount of expertise. Oftentimes, the process of actually placing a building or a location on the National Register is done through a company that has to be hired out, that does the research and fills out the paperwork.
Another barrier is that in order to get a place designated as historic, the nominations have to come organically from the community. Jeremy Ebersole is executive director of the Milwaukee Preservation Alliance, which works to help people navigate the complicated process of historic preservation.
Preservation is not about preserving only certain types of significances, only certain populations, stories. Anyone in this city can and should be willing to submit a nomination for a building if that place is important to your community.
Listener Eloisa is a history buff at heart. But for her, as a Mexican Milwaukeean whose family was part of many early community gatherings, the question is personal.
We all do want those roots. And so if we don't do things like that, we lose something of personal value to us individually, as a family, and as a larger community.
To find out what is being done locally to preserve Latino heritage sites and how you can nominate a place for historic designation, go to our site, wuwm.com. Angelina Mosier Salazar, 89.7, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Sun Badger Solar. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit WUWM.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
Coming up in about 14 minutes, gardening expert Melinda Myers gives us her tips for starting seeds indoors and what plants to start right now.
Right now, it's a good time to start broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower, those things that like it cool, because they'll be ready to plant outside end of April. They'll be a good size, not too big.
We'll learn more in just a moment, but first we take a trip to the Tandem to see how the restaurant has adapted to meet the needs of their community during this pandemic. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. All restaurants have had to adapt to the pandemic. For most, that looks like carryout and delivery. But for the Tandem restaurant in the Lindsay Heights neighborhood of Milwaukee, the pandemic has changed everything. In fact, they're not even cooking anymore, but serving as a distribution center to provide meals for people who are hungry and struggling with food insecurity. Through donations, a grant from the World Central Kitchen, and now a contract with the City of Milwaukee, the Tandem is getting food to people who need it. Restaurants from around the community have been bringing meals to the Tandem, where workers sort them by dietary restrictions and delivery routes, and then they're on their way. Lake Effect's Ben Binversi stopped by the restaurant turned makeshift food delivery hub to talk to the founder and owner of the Tandem, Caitlin Cullen, as well as one of her employees, Chuck Littlejohn, as they started sorting meals for the day's delivery.
Chuck Littlejohn has been working at the Tandem for almost 4 years, but in recent months, he's seen his job title change from dishwasher to delivery man, and the restaurant feels a bit different.
It changed a lot. We was a restaurant at first, and then when the pandemic came, it seemed like everything was empty in here. We had to clean all the time because of the pandemic. It just kind of crazy when you first come in and don't see nothing. So it's kind of difficult at first.
The Tandem shifted to meet the needs of the pandemic. The change has been difficult at times, but delivering meals to people facing hunger has kept Chuck motivated.
Well, just to see the smile on their face every day, you know. It's just something about their smile and how happy they be when they get it. You know, it just keeps you going every day. It made me work a little more harder. It's been amazing through the 3 years I've been here. A lot of change, but we're still moving and we're still going. And that's the main thing, helping and keeping everybody okay.
I asked owner Caitlin Cullen about the restaurant's mission and how it's changed since the pandemic.
It's changed a lot. I mean, we've always been like a community-focused social enterprise restaurant. So in the beginning, our goal was really to employ young people or folks who have a hard time getting a job, basically due to like lack of experience or a record of incarceration. That was our primary focus, and it remains a huge part of our focus now. But really getting young people into the workforce, connecting Milwaukee restaurants to an untapped potential of like Northside workers who are really capable and awesome in the kitchen but have very few opportunities afforded them. And also just getting everyone in the city to hang out with each other more. I think that third part has really stayed very constant even during the pandemic, and the pandemic's turned our world upside down. You know, we went from feeding folks and training young people in a learning kitchen to laying off everyone except for the folks who weren't the youngest. You know what I mean? Like young women with families that they had to support. Our age range dramatically changed when the pandemic hit, because anyone who had a support system, we asked them to voluntarily lay themselves off, go stay with their mom, and really took the older crew on full time. We remain a really community-focused social enterprise, but our focus for the past year has been food insecurity and hunger relief. So because we're a restaurant, we always have something to eat, even if we don't have enough money to support ourselves, which most restaurant workers are pretty broke. But you always get to eat here and figure stuff out. And really when the pandemic hit, none of us had any security systems or support to fall on. So we really started making these meals to support our community, but also to support our staff that had been laid off. And it just really spiraled out of control. And we've been doing it for over a year.
Yeah.
And it's the only thing we do. And now we don't even cook anything anymore.
Yeah. Restaurants from around the community are giving you the food. Are you paying them?
Yeah. Okay. So through a variety of funding sources, and it's changed over time, right? In the summer, in the beginning of the pandemic, it was donations. By the summer, it was through the global nonprofit, the World Central Kitchen. And now that we're in the winter, the City of Milwaukee, we actually hold a contract with them using federal CARES Act dollars. And okay. So folks had started to trust us with their money, whether it be private donations, foundation money, or now the city. They started to trust us to do the work because they had seen it done. And it's also a lot easier to contract with one person as opposed to the 50 plus restaurants we've worked with. So the thought process was, let's go and get this money, use it to prop up restaurants that are really struggling right now, and have it feed folks. And we'll just use the money that we're bringing in for our overhead costs. And our guys will go from being cooks to delivery drivers. So it was a pretty simple transition.
It is a little chaotic. I mean, it seems like you guys have a system down and it's working well.
It's a dumpster fire. Yeah, I mean, it's like chaos. We've been doing this. The delivery is the hardest thing I think we've ever done. And we've been doing this for 3 months and it's still complicated. There really is no perfect way to make it happen.
Yeah, and you were not necessarily prepared for this either, this sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, we were practicing for it. So we've been doing a delivery model pilot with the neighborhood of Metcalf Park, with the ladies from Metcalf Park Community Bridges, since midsummer. Okay. And we knew we wanted to try and deliver things. Winter in Wisconsin is a terrible time to be sitting outside, waiting for food, trying to travel a lot of times because the roads are so bad. That we knew we were gonna have to try and do it. But you know, we're bootstrapping this. This is like, we've got two $400 computers, Google Sheets, and a $10 driver delivery app. This is not like some, you know, $15,000 website at this point. And we really wanted to make it work, first and foremost, for residents who needed food but weren't able to get out and about in the winter months. Work for restaurants who, if you remember November, were like hitting their worst month to date. And then also maybe pilot it well enough that we could replicate a delivery mechanism outside of this program, right? So that when we're done doing this and we go back to being a restaurant, the city and the county might actually have ways to help the food insecure in a way that they don't have to get in the car, if they have a car.
Yeah. During the pandemic, the need for people to get food has been highlighted, and restaurants during normal times, quote unquote, are not necessarily, most of them are not serving people who are struggling to eat and struggling with food insecurity.
I think you'd be surprised at how much work restaurants do for food insecurity very quietly.
Okay.
I mean, we've been in business 4 years, and I always joke that three of them we've been going out of business. Like, the restaurant industry is really tough, but I think we are an industry that's also very participatory in our communities at all times, and it shows up in ways you may not anticipate, right? So it's not just like a donation to Feeding America or Hunger Task Force. It's often, you know, picking a month of the year where a percentage of sales goes to Courage MKE, which is like a house for transient queer youth, right? And that money goes towards feeding them and sheltering them. So I think the direct, like, cooking food, putting in a box and handing it to folks who are facing hunger is different. But I think we've always kind of been a part of that process. It just looks a lot different now.
Okay. What has this pandemic kind of showed you or made you realize about the food system and restaurant system in the community of Milwaukee?
A lot. The first thing I noticed was, at the Tandem, we pay people generally higher than the industry average. And when I laid off my workers, and myself included, we had no savings. So the way that we are compensating people is inappropriate. And as an industry, it's just become so baked into how everything happens. And because the McDonald's and the Chipotle's of the world artificially decrease the price of goods for folks, a lot has to change in terms of how much we charge for food and how much we pay our staff. And really building in also like paid time off for sickness, figuring out how to maybe get a health insurance policy for the staff. That's my biggest takeaway.
So how long are you planning on continuing this current status quo of you guys delivering meals out to the community?
We are budgeted to do this through the end of April.
Okay.
So the goal of the delivery program was to get us through the cold months. Every year I've lived in Wisconsin, it snowed in April, and so that was our our end game. And also to help restaurants circle the corner, or kind of round that corner towards patio season. So despite what the landscape might look like, they can still function. as I was saying earlier, how we would love to like find a way to turn this into a long-term program, or at least have done the legwork for the city or the county to pick up something like this. We're hoping to extend the program a little bit. So for example, in the month of March, we did roughly 2,500 to 3,000 deliveries weekly. And we had 1,000 people each week on that wait list. So there is an unmet need. And so we're hoping to go sometime into the summer.
The need for food is not going to go away. It's not going to go away.
The need for us to do it is going to go away. You know what I mean? And that I don't address food insecurity. I have for a year now, but I'm a restaurant. And so the need for restaurants to do it the way that we have, which is to react quickly with our skill set, which is making cheap stuff into something delicious, that came out of necessity. The relationships between restaurant and the food insecure, I think, is one, like I said, that has existed, but maybe is now headed in a new direction and could be something that always happens. But we also are more expensive than your traditional avenues of, you know, pantries and soup kitchens. Mm-hmm. So whether or not that goes on forever, I don't know. But I think, like, there should be a world, especially in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where it's winter 6 months out of the year, where someone who is food insecure and likely doesn't have access to transportation should be able to get those items delivered to their home.
Yeah. You know, it seems like the restaurant is like the vehicle for a lot of other things that you're doing here. You're doing tutoring, and food is a part of that. Why was food originally the locus of where you would make that change from? And how does it continue to be that for you? Why food?
Food is the easiest way to manipulate people. On a very functional level, like, people need food, people like food, and everyone eats it. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. When we open, like, restaurant work is reliable. Restaurant work, except for a global pandemic. So until this past year, restaurant work is reliable. You can find it anywhere. It hinges on the same kind of skills over and over, and there's a lot of room for growth. So, I mean, I started in a restaurant cooking cheesesteaks to drunk people at 2 a.m. after bar close, and I ended up being the sous chef of a James Beard, like, thrice nominated restaurant. There's a lot of room for growth, and both professional and personal. So I thought that'd be a really good way to engage young people in work, or folks who are non-traditional job candidates, in that, like, anyone can do it. Literally, like, you don't have to have graduated high school. Like, there's all kinds of things in a restaurant that are intuitive, they're interpersonal. You can learn a lot of physical skills, but they're also like job skills, personal skills. So that was a huge part of it. And I think our secondary focus has always been connecting Milwaukeeans who don't normally interact. And food is a great way to manipulate that into happening. If we've got a great fried chicken that somebody who in the neighborhood is gonna wanna eat, but also somebody down, you know, on the east side who's like mega hipster is gonna wanna enjoy, then I'm gonna get those people in the same building when they might not normally interact.
Yeah.
And so I think that was a huge part of it. It was because young people could really work with it. I found a lot of myself in cooking. But also so that we could force people who don't normally hang out to kick it in the same room.
Cool. Well, thank you, Caitlin, for the work that y'all are doing here at the Tandem and for taking the time to talk on it. Lake Effect,
Coming here and being here for far too long this morning, Ben. The chaos never ends.
Caitlin Cullen is the owner and founder of the Tandem. Chuck Littlejohn is a delivery man at the restaurant. They spoke with Lake Effect's Ben Binversi. You can learn more about the Tandem's work at WUWM.com. With the beautiful weather over the weekend, many of us are hoping to exercise our green thumbs. It's the perfect time to start seeds for summer gardens. And as always, Melinda Myers has some advice on how to do it right. Myers is an expert on all things gardening, and she joins me now to talk about starting seeds and winter sowing. Melinda, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
My pleasure.
What are the kinds of seeds that you should start inside right now?
You know, always check the seed packet because it'll tell you start this X number of weeks before the last spring frost. And, you know, even though you look at the average, I usually say Memorial Day is when we start planting out tomatoes and peppers. The middle of May is when we can do beans and corn. So kind of keep those dates in mind as you're counting back. So right now it's a good time to start broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower, those things that like it cool, because they'll be ready to plant outside end of April. They'll be a good size, not too big. Wait on those tomatoes and peppers until early April. As much as we want to start them, bigger is not always better. It's more transplant shock. But all the information you need is on the back of a quality seed packet.
So what are some of your tips for starting seeds indoors? I know that location can be pretty key.
You bet. So most seeds don't need light to germinate, but they need warmth. And so in my house, it's pretty cool. I keep it cool. So I start all my seeds in my closet. There's no light, but it's the warmest room in my house. As soon as they sprout, I get them out and I put them either in a bright sunny window, or actually I've had much better success. I use LED plant lights, much more powerful, energy efficient, and the cost has come drastically dropped. So it's an affordable option. And so as soon as you see the green, put them under light or into a sunny window. That's when they need that sunlight. Clean containers, a sterile planting mix or seed starting mix, and then quality seeds. So warmth to germinate, light once they're up and growing, keep the soil slightly moist, and then you'll need to fertilize with a very dilute solution of fertilizer every couple of weeks. Again, check the bag. It'll tell you the potting mix, oh, it's got a slow-release fertilizer. You won't need to start as quickly, or maybe, you know, as soon as those leaves are up and growing, very dilute solution of any kind of liquid houseplant fertilizer.
So about how big should they be before you start putting them in the garden?
You know, good question. So one is the weather outside. Okay, so we want to make sure it's nice and warm. I like using floating row covers. They're fabric that lets air, light, and water through but traps the heat, and they're low maintenance. I can put my plants in, cover them, anchor it, and I'm done, and leave enough slack. A lot of times I'll put clear plastic, you know, over the garden, get some of those annual weeds to sprout, lightly cultivate. I'm eliminating like half the weeds before I plant. I've warmed the soil, less shock for the plants, and then I can get those transplants in. We also want to gradually introduce them to the outdoors. You know, they've been inside under lights or a sunny window. It's nice inside, and then we put them outside. So the first day, give them maybe an hour of direct sunlight. Then the next day, two, three, four, five, so on. And stop fertilizing till you get them in the garden. And so that's a way to gradually, it's called hardening off. And that's a good way to get them used to the outdoors.
There was something that I was looking up that was called winter sowing. What is that?
You know, I learned this method when I was speaking in Fort Wayne a few years ago, and a couple of gardeners presented it. And it's a cool idea because you don't need lights, you don't need to water every day, so it's very low maintenance. Take a milk jug, drill four holes on the bottom, or a soda bottle, a 2-liter soda bottle, cut the top off so the bottom is about 4 inches deep, and then you leave the handle attached, you know, so there's just this little part attached. Fill that bottom with potting mix, you know, and you've got the drainage holes in the bottom, moisten, then plant your seeds. Now you could do your broccoli, Brussels sprouts, you could do a lot of your perennial herbs right now. Then you close it, duct tape it's shut, take the cap off, and put it, I put mine on the south side of my house, but away so that they do get rain and snow. Check them if we have a dry spring. And it is amazing. You know, the first time I did it, I thought, well, if I have 50% success, I'll be happy. I had cone flowers. Chives are pretty easy, but I did chives. I even did some tomatoes. But it's a great way, very low maintenance. And I think it's something that is fun to do with kids, but at gardeners of all ages, because you don't need special equipment. And, you know, I did perennials and I could divide them out, plant them out, and one packet of seeds, I got 20 plants versus one plant that could cost a little more. So you can take your plant budget and stretch it further that way.
Yeah, what is the benefit of that versus starting a seed indoors?
It's really I think it's the input you have to do. So the benefit, you know, indoors you get to touch and feel, which I think right now some of us are dying for some greenery. So there's that benefit that I have something to tend. But you also need to be there daily or have someone in your house that can check the moisture every day. You need to have good light. And sunny windows usually aren't enough. You know, our days aren't that long yet. The sun isn't that intense. So we end up with long, leggy transplants.
plants, but we get to tend them and we get to watch them and we get to nurture them. And outside, it's just you put them in there, you set them out, you check occasionally, make sure the soil's moist, and that's it. So from a convenience standpoint, winter sowing is great. You can do a lot without needing a lot of lighting and space, but you miss that nurturing part.
What is the danger of them getting too leggy indoors?
Good question. So we used to start our tomatoes, and I meet old-time gardeners, I might qualify for that as well, that still want to start them in the middle of March. But what we found is they were long, the stems were weak because the light intensity wasn't that great, and so it's more of a shock to the plant when we put it out. Rather, when you start with a smaller plant, it's been growing inside for a shorter period, so the transition's easier. It's usually a stockier plant, and it's less of a transplant shock going out.
All right. Well, Melinda Myers, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Well, thank you.
Melinda Myers is a gardening expert and the author of many books on the subject, including Small Space Gardening and Midwest Gardener's Handbook. You can find more of our conversations about gardening, including tips on caring for indoor plants, at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, you can find all of our content as a podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or really wherever you're getting your podcasts. And if you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, look for Lake Effect Spotlight. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about a new report on Wisconsin's prison population, which has dipped to a 20-year low, in part due to the pandemic. That'll be tomorrow at 10 on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.